Bashpocalypse 2014.
It's a terrific great way to deal with the smoke and the flames now. Andy Framer's rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the friends.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 338, broadcasting this week from a Bashpocalypse-proof bunker somewhere in the Australian outback. Latest reports indicate headless admins have been seen riding flaming horses towards a blood-red moon. Amazon is preparing a global reboot, worms unleashed, patches not patching, chaos, blood running in the streets. Oh, the humanity. Yeah, everyone's been pretty busy this week dealing with shell shock, the so-called shell shock vulnerability. We'll be talking about that in a minute in the news segment with Adam Boileau. And apart from covering the apparent end of the world, which is happening right now, we're also having a detailed look at the Internet of Things and junk hacking this week. We'll be joined by Security Mouse founder Don Bailey in this week's feature interview. He wrote a very interesting blog post this week in response to a Daily Dave post by Dave Itell that dissed so-called junk hacking. Itell says the "Hey, I can own my toaster" phenomenon has gone just a little bit too far, and his post attracted a strong reaction from many researchers, but a very well thought out response from Don, who says it is time to move our focus from looking at individual devices towards looking at the IoT ecosystem at a more macro level. This week's show is brought to you by Context Information Security. Big thanks to them. And in this week's sponsor interview, we're continuing the IoT theme, sort of, with a great bit of device reversing performed by Context's research director, Michael Jordan. He got Doom to run on a Canon printer, which I think is actually pretty awesome. And it's proof that even your basic network-attached printers these days can be a real problem. I'm sure you all remember when high-end print and copy centers used to ship with unpatchable versions of NT4. Yeah, well, we're sort of back to those days again. But it's a bigger problem now because cheap printers are affected in the same way that these old ones used to be, and some security teams may have been neglecting them because they weren't previously a problem. Fantastic. But let's get into the news now with Adam. And mate, I hear the world ended this week.
Yeah, I guess, man, I guess it kind of did. For those, I'm sure no one has not seen this, but there's a bug in Bash. In particular, there's a bug in the way that Bash parses user-supplied environment variables, such that where an attacker can control the contents of an environment variable, they can execute arbitrary Bash code, which is bad. But yes, people have been hooking Bash into all sorts of things for, well, it turns out pretty much as far back as Bash has been written. This bug has been there at least 15 years, perhaps more like 20 in Bash. And yes, people have hooked Bash up to CGI scripts on web servers. They've hooked Bash up to, you know, their mail system, to their DHCP clients, to, you know, every embedded system ever that uses Bash to glue things together. Your Android phone runs Bash. It's absolutely everywhere. This has been a real mess the last few days on the internet. Everyone's been patching like crazy, and we've been, you know, talking about the apocalypse and the world ending and the inevitable comparisons with Heartbleed in terms of impact. But it's been a hectic few days.
Yeah, some asshole apparently, I mean, and this was just a rumor, but apparently some asshole was actually wrote a script that was going around injecting RM commands into vulnerable CGI.
Well, you know, I guess that's not the worst thing you can do to someone's box that's vulnerable. I mean, taking it over and using it to own all the rest of their things and all their customers, probably worse than RMing it. At least you've taken it out of the gene pool, so to speak. But yeah, there's stuff's getting owned all over the internet. We've seen large scale scanning for vulnerable CGI scripts. Obviously, everything that uses SSH restricted trusts. That's one of the areas that hasn't really been strongly reported on around this bug, is that this allows you to bypass the force command directive in SSH when you're using key authentication and restricting what people can do. You can bypass that, and that's a really big deal in a lot of environments. That's a control that we've relied on quite a lot. But yeah, there's just a lot of things that can go. I've seen multiple local privesc on OS X. We've seen vulnerabilities that get your command exec from the web admin interface of, for example, F5 appliances. This bug is absolutely everywhere. In a way that's sort of evocative of that LZO compression bug we talked about a while back, or Heartbleed.
Yeah, but this is easier to exploit and easier to do remotely. You know, like it's not like, oh yeah, I'm going to send you an image and get you to view it. This is just like, like, oh, hello, Gateway. Give me, you know, let me execute commands. Sure.
Yeah. And this is, you know, absolutely, you know, 10 out of 10 on the CVSS rating. You know, like complexity is very, very low. Exploitability is very, very high. You know, every sysadmin who's seen the proof of concept example, which is, you know, a few characters you can type in, immediately understands how you could turn that into a remote exploit. Like, it's really not, you know, you don't require much particular sophisticated, you know, hacker knowledge to be able to use this for something. Mm. It's bad.
Well, and Robert Graham, there was a minor controversy this week with Robert Graham actually scanning the internet, like using a script that would ping back a box that he could then see if people were vulnerable, which kind of amounted to, you know, executing commands on people's boxes without authorization. I thought it was, it's one thing to do that, but it's another thing to tweet about it. And there was a bit of a to and fro about that actually this week.
Yeah, there was a bit of drama on the Twitterverse about that. And I think, you know, it would be fairly clear that that was access in excess of your authority if you're in New Zealand. You know, I think our law would be pretty clear that that would be a bad idea. But on the other hand...
Well, I think that's illegal in Australia as well. And I think under the CFAA, even having the thought to do that would probably be a crime.
Yeah, I mean, everything appears to be a computer crime in the US. But, you know, there's a big difference between doing it and then actually getting prosecuted for it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not expecting him to be taken away in cuffs either. But still, man, that's ballsy doing that.
Yeah, and he the results he got, he was scanning, you know, /0, the entire internet for, you know, the front page of web servers that don't require a host header and have a bash CGI hooked up to the front page. So a relatively small proportion of the internet is going to, you know, meet those prerequisites. And he got something like 3,000 pings back before, you know, his script got it going horribly wrong, and presumably before people started spotting him and then, you know, sending ICMP to his listening post to mess with his results. But yeah, that's those 3,000 boxes, they got owned today. I mean, somebody else took his proof of concept and replaced the ping with installer, you know, Linux botnet client, and off you go. So all those boxes got owned today. So it's at least 3,000. Someone ripped off the script and off they went. But I mean, if you start looking for individual scripts that you know are vulnerable, you can find default ones like cPanel, for example. The control panel software had one in it. If you start scanning for that, I mean, you know, there's a lot of cPanel out there.
Yeah, there sure is, and it's not exactly quickly updated depending on the provider that's running that stuff either. But
I mean,
what do we know about just how widespread the ownage is? Because I've seen reports of like a whole bunch of US.gov domains getting owned. You know, there's been a bit of talk about a worm going around. There's been talk of like, no, there's worse worms coming. Like, just how much carnage is there out there at the moment?
Well, there certainly seems to be a few worms going for the low-hanging fruit, the easy CGI wins, and that's going to continue. We'll see those being, you know, recruited into your average, you know, DDoS botnets and that kind of thing. Part of the problem with bugs like this, you know, is if that you own one box, you can take your time to figure out what you can use on that box to own other things. If you own 10,000 boxes or 100,000 boxes, you're actually much more limited in how you can use them just by virtue of not being able to look at them, you know, individually. So I think we'll see some automated ownage from worms, and that will, you know, hopefully result in people getting patched. We'll probably see some people rolling, you know, quote, beneficial worms, unquote, you know, things that will go around and attempt to patch bash. I would not be surprised if one of those is doing the rounds already. You know, app get upgrade if you happen to hit a CGI that's running as root or something, some other vector that ends up with it running as root, you could patch it yourself. We may see that start to happen. There's exploits in the wild for DHCP on Linux. So if you're running Red Hat or you're running...
I've heard talk about that, but how would you actually use that? Would you just have to get in the middle? I mean, how does that work?
Well, basically, you run a malicious DHCP server. So wireless hotspot in a public place, serve up DHCP, receive root shells on boxes that go past you.
Okay, that makes sense.
There's a proof of concept of that already floating around.
Yeah.
So, and that's a very, you know, very real way to compromise people. Although, you know, how many people run Linux on the desktop and move around with their laptops? You know, probably not a massive amount. Although, if they can make that work against Android's DHCP client, that would be a different story.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a number of people listening who are dealing with this. But do you have any advice into like what should people be doing? What should be their first responses? Because I'm sure there's a list of 50 different things that people have to do because of this. What's your top five?
Well, I mean, the most important one obviously is patch bash. And if you have modern supported Linux, you know, there's been patches rolling for the last couple of days. Some of the patches are imperfect, but the patches that we've seen at least fix the basic naive exploitation case. And the jury's kind of still out on whether or not the subsequent bypass of that patch will actually result in usable code exec. So obviously patch your bash first. The second thing is try to figure out what other stuff in your environment you have to worry about. And that's basically all of your appliances. all of your embedded stuff, anything that's likely to have Bash plumbed into it. I mean, even Windows boxes running Cygwin. You know, people laugh when you make jokes like that. But I mean, you know, nuclear reactors run on Windows boxes running Cygwin, right? It is a thing that happens. So figuring out what other areas of your environment, you know, could plausibly depend upon it, and then figuring out how you're going to patch them, or at least how you.
Well, and of course, there won't be patches for a lot of this stuff as well, because quite often the people who build this sort of equipment don't really even think about stuff like this.
No, I mean, and you know, that's probably going to be the outcome of this process of figuring out what's vulnerable. You're going to have to go, okay, we can't defend these things. We have to look at our segregation. We have to look at our logging and the detective controls. You know, and this is all stuff you probably should have already done. Right? If you're running control systems or embedded stuff that's really important, you know, you would have had to deal with all the other problems that they've had in the last, you know, 10 years or so. So, you know, having architectural controls that prevent this turning into catastrophic failure. But on the other hand, you just, you know, Bash is everywhere.
It seems like you're saying the hype is justified.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we haven't seen a bug like this in the you know, I'm trying to think of the last time we saw one that was this widespread, this easily exploited, that results in straight up easy code exec. But we just haven't seen one like this in, I mean, I'm thinking back to, you know, like bugs in Bind and SSHX2, you know, like the golden era of the late 90s of, you know, of remote Unix exploits.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking early 2000s as well, like IIS superfluous decoding vuln, dot printer in IIS 5, you know, I mean, it's that level, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, yes. And I mean, in many ways, worse, because it's not just one piece of software. Yeah. Bash is integrated to so much other stuff, and there's so many vectors to it. You know, at least when you look at, say, the IIS bugs, you can say, okay, it's via HTTP or HTTPS, or, you know, you can kind of quickly identify the vectors. Whereas, you know, with this, like your mail spool, you know, like your mail processing stack might pass out mail to, you know, your spam assassin or something and pass data in the environment.
Procmail's affected by this, isn't it?
Yeah, like Procmail's. Well, I mean, in some configurations, it appears that people can use Procmail. Like, that's just delivering mail. And what about, you know, SNMP? What about your log analysis? What about your, like, the shell script that reads your web logs and then generates pretty graphs, right? I mean, all of these things use, I mean, the Bash environment variables are the way you store variable data in Bash, right? You basically can't write a Bash script and not use them. And, you know, there's just so much stuff that's glued together by shell scripts that, you know, probably people don't think about anymore and just works. And, you know, we're going to be understanding the impact of this for years to come, you know. And once your infrastructure is compromised, that's the other thing, right? I mean, we're focusing quite a lot on the web servers and the client side compromises, like by DHCP and things. But when your upstream software supply infrastructure gets compromised by this, and I'm thinking, you know, Debian Project, Red Hat, you know, Ubuntu, SUSE, kernel.org, you know, SourceForge, all these people, GitHub, all these people who have, you know, big Unix infrastructure that is very, very tied into our supply chain, that only needs to get compromised once, you know? And once someone's up in there and can Trojan the packages being delivered out, then, you know, you own a lot more things. And getting people out of that kind of infrastructure is pretty difficult.
So when the City Morning Herald says Bash bug labeled largest ever to hit the internet, that's actually not hype.
No, I don't know by what metric what dimension of large it is. But yes, it is certainly a big deal. I'm struggling to think of one that's been this big in a while. I mean, you know, I think a better comparison than an individual bug is almost SQL injection, right? I mean, it's kind of like it's almost a bug class rather than even though it is only one bug.
Yeah, but I mean, unlike SQL injection, you can patch this by fixing Bash, right? And I understand that there's going to be stuff that's going to remain vulnerable out there, but SQL injection is worse in that it relies on developers not being stupid to mitigate, right? This doesn't.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I guess if you see, it's not a perfect analogy, is it, the SQL injection thing? But I think in general, injection attacks like this are, it's an ongoing, you know, gift from the bug gods that will get things compromised, for a long time to come. And even though we can fix it, I guess, in a lot of cases by patching Bash.
And the best thing, of course, is that this has been there forever.
And there's been a lot of, rather snide tweeting about, many eyes making light work of bugs and open source peer review and all that kind of thing. But in the end, the guy who really is having the rough time of this is probably Chet Ramey, the maintainer of Bash, who must be having a pretty rough couple of days. So, yeah. Hats off to you, buddy.
Yeah. I don't think I'd swap places with him for all the tea in China, no. As the saying goes.
Yeah.
But it hasn't just been Bash that's copped it this week. Mozilla has patched, oh God, it's a hell of a bug, this NSS bug.
Yeah. comedy crypto, yes. So there's apparently there was a variant of the classic Blackenbacher RSA signature forgery bug in Mozilla's NSS library, which is essentially their portable network security services library. It's just been, it's kind of long begot from the Mozilla browser of old, but it's, you know, a part of all of their software stack, and it's used for doing SSL validation. And apparently, yeah, they had a variant of this bug that lets you essentially bypass certificate authentication for RSA SSL certificates, which is, ah, oh dear. Any other week, that would have been a big deal bug, but not this week.
Now, you know how we've theorized that if a bug in Amazon's sort of modified version of Xen ever popped up, it could cause them some serious troubles. Well, guess what?
Yep, it appears that Amazon is in the middle of rolling reboots across their entire, pretty much their entire fleet of EC2 virtualized boxes to patch some kind of Xen bug, the details of which are still embargoed until the first of next month. At that point, I guess we'll find out about whatever juicy details it was. Of course, the money is on a a guest to host or a guest to guest bug. But anyway, so they've got to the point where Amazon's director of EC2 is in the forums trying to placate customers who are having their stuff rebooted, and everybody else who runs Xen is just going to have to wait and get this, whatever horrific bug it is dropped on them on the first of next month, and then have to scramble to patch things. So yes, that would also be a big deal any other day of the week.
Yeah, well, I mean, lucky they caught this, and lucky it's been, because Amazon runs a lot of the internet. Do you know what I mean? If someone had have actually weaponized this.
Internet weapon.
And unleashed it on their infrastructure, that would be, you'd notice it. Like, everyone would notice it. It would be leading the 6 o'clock bulletins.
Well, unless they were sneaky about it, maybe they did find this in the wild. Maybe someone's just been quietly using it.
Mm.
We just don't know for a bit, but they certainly wouldn't come out and say so if they had caught it on the quiet. They don't want to disrupt confidence in their cloud. But yeah, we just don't know yet. We'll have to wait and see.
Now, in some other fantastic news, there's been some new laws passed in Australia.
Yeah, what exactly is going on over there? It sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah, look, because, IS is a giant fireball heading towards planet Australia. Apparently. Look, we discussed these. They've been on the cards for a while. Basically, there's a whole bunch of new laws which will enable our intelligence services essentially to own third-party systems in order to access a target. So it's really targeted at ASD want to own or ASIO want to own a jihadi forum and drop malware on user X. Do you know what I mean? So they can then go and own that forum. That's one use case for these laws. But they've put no upper limit on the number of hosts that they can own to hit the target, which is now being written up by the Sydney Morning Herald as, well, theoretically, they could get one warrant which would enable them to own the entire internet, right? Which I think is, look, it is a little bit hyperbolic, but at the same time, I recognize, look, I think their editorial strategy is sound here, because you look at what happened in the US with the phone call metadata. That was warranted. The FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in the United States, was not designed so that the NSA could go to the FISA court and ask for a warrant that would cause all of the telcos there to cough up all of their metadata on absolutely everyone, right? So vaguely worded national security legislation tends to get abused. Scott Ludlam's been standing up in the Senate giving our Attorney General, our smug shit of an Attorney General, as hard a time as he could actually muster to try to, get some amendments into this thing. But of course, the opposition party here, the Australian Labor Party, sided with the government and, the package got through. They've also introduced laws that would see someone like myself, if I obtained information on an active so-called designated special intelligence operation, and I thought that was in the public interest and wanted to report on that. If they catch wind of it, they can tell me not to report on it, and I could face prison time if I choose to report on it anyway.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty hostile thing for both whistleblowers and for the media. We've seen a lot of aggression against whistleblowers, but to really kind of extend that out to the media seems pretty...
Well, they've firmed up the penalties for people who are leaking classified information, which you kind of expect after Manning and Snowden, right? You do expect that. But the stuff targeting the media is slightly concerning. And again, I understand where the intent of this legislation actually comes from. Which was some years ago, the Australian newspaper, one of, Rupert Murdoch's flagship Australian newspaper, caught wind of some terror raids that were planned in Melbourne. And they went to the AFP and ASIO and said, look, we've got this story, we're going to run it. And the AFP and ASIO just said, God, please don't, this is going to be a disaster. What wound up happening is the papers hit the stands early one morning and they had to bring the raids forward, and it was just, the whole thing was a disaster, basically. So I think that's what these laws have been designed to do, so that if I say, hey, I hear you're about to go, you know, kick in some jihadis' doors next week, and I'm going to run a front page story about it, they can say, no, you're not. So again, the intent of the draft is reasonable, but it's so vague and so wide ranging that it's going to be abused. How long before the Attorney General just says, no, that's a special intelligence operation? Anytime something embarrassing, they're confronted with something embarrassing from a journalist, they can just declare it a special intelligence operation and threaten you with prison. It's an appalling assault on the freedom of the media, and it's bad for democracy.
Yeah, I concur, and I guess they haven't you know, matched this with a significant increase in oversight, I'm assuming.
Oh, fuck no. Why would they do that? I mean, look, there's... No, they haven't. The whole thing's a disaster. No. And of course, you know, they're using this hysteria around IS, because recently IS named Australia as, you know, go forth and attack the infidels of Australia and, you know, slash them in the street. All of this is, of course, being exploited by the government to make us terrified, or to make people terrified and say we need these laws, which clearly we don't. It's just, it's completely unnecessary. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's crazy town, man. Crazy town.
It is. Anyway, I'll stop ranting now. Now, moving on, you know, we covered the story last week where Microsoft has apparently disbanded its trustworthy computing group. The hysterical elements of the Twitterati jumped up and down and said, oh, Microsoft has stopped doing security. And of course, now we're seeing the headlines with Scott Charney, who is the head of Trustworthy Computing Group, going, no, that was kind of my decision, and this is part of a bigger restructure.
Yeah, which I think it does make sense. And we talked a bit about it last week that, you know, they have to do security in a lot more diverse ways throughout their entire organization. And, you know, having a centralized group may not have been the best structure. It certainly wasn't, you know, an admission of failure or anything, which did seem to be sort of the line that Twitter was taking.
So, yeah, move along. Nothing to really see there. Oh, here's a fun one. Kevin Mitnick seems to be capitalizing on his brand, which, I mean, if I was Kevin, I'd probably do the same thing. He's now selling O-Days. He's moved to the zero-day exploit broking marketplace, which is kind of an unexpected development, really.
Yeah, he's launched Mitnick's absolute zero-day exploit exchange, where you can buy either exclusive access to exploits or indeed request exploits for things if you're willing to pony up a large amount of cash. Apparently, the smallest bug he will deign to deal with is $100,000 worth. So it remains to be seen, you know, quite how big the market is for publicly buying $100,000 exclusive exploits. I mean, that seems like a niche that doesn't really exist in the market to me. I mean, either you're a spook or a criminal organization, and then you're buying them to use them, or, you know, you're a red team or a pen test crowd or, you know, a corporate, in which case you're probably not going to blow $100,000 on a bug just to test your, you know, response capability. There's better ways to do it than that. So I'm not quite sure who's buying, but Kevin's selling.
Chris Segoyan, of course, from the ACLU. He's, I think he's had an aneurysm over this.
Yeah, Chris came out on Twitter and said, if you're going to sell O-Day, which I don't recommend, using a convicted felon as a broker seems unnecessarily risky. So, yeah, a few shots fired there.
Well, and Mitnick's response was, my clients may use them to monitor your activities. How do you like them apples, Chris? Which is, you know, and there's a few people who are true believers in, you know, free Kevin Mitnick, who are like, I'm so disillusioned, I'm so disappointed. Man, whatever. It's an established marketplace, you know, and he's just moving to presumably use his brand as an extremely well-known person. You know, I doubt he'll be doing much of the brokering himself. He'll probably just oversee the business and, you know, he's trying to make coin like everyone else. But yeah, it's a bit of a shift because he's been very much against the man, and now he's like, hey, man, hey, the man, do you want to buy some O-Day? So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's funny how these things work out.
Now, speaking of people who've been busted doing some sketchy stuff, as Kevin was in a former life, apparently Home Depot's former security architect had a pretty shady history. In fact, he may be in prison right now for doing naughty things with computers. And of course, Home Depot, what was it, 57 million card details stolen in April this year? But yeah, this is a hell of a twist on the story.
Yeah, apparently this guy, Ricky Joe Mitchell, a.k.a. Rick Dog with two G's, was not only some manner of virus writer in high school, but was recently indicted and arrested for his you know, work, I'm putting this in scare quotes, with Enervest Operating, some kind of oil and gas company where he was previously in a security role. He left the company and he went back in and apparently like factory reset all their stuff and then shut it down and caused like millions of dollars worth of lost business and caused them to lose a whole bunch bunch of data anyway. He was prosecuted for this. And as you say, may well actually now be in jail. And he was, this was actually unfolding whilst he was the security architect for Home Depot. So, maybe not the best choice that Home Depot's HR department could have made when hiring a new security architect. You know, why'd you leave your last job, sir? Well, you know, I kind of tried to burn their operation to the ground. Yeah. Not really the winning interview answer there.
Well, and apparently a lot of their InfoSec people, you know, according to this next piece also from Ars Technica, a lot of their security staff actually walked because people had been saying to management, hey, guys, you know, we've got to do something here. We're going to get owned. And yeah, they'd been warning them for a long, long time, for years, and nothing was happening. And it led to resignations and all sorts of drama. But yeah, I mean, I guess this is what happens when everyone who works in your IT department says, fix this, we're going to get owned. You know, chances are you're going to get owned.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. And I guess Home Depot is going to pay for it.
PayPal is continuing its plans to accept Bitcoin. It looks like this is getting real.
Yeah, it appears that they're partnering with a number of the existing Bitcoin processors to kind of start integrating into their business. At the moment, it doesn't sound like a complete integration with your PayPal wallet, but yeah, there's some arrangement where PayPal merchants will be able to sell and have their Bitcoins transacted through BitPay or Coinbase or GoCoin. And that's got to be good for the Bitcoin ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, it's certainly going to make it a little bit more stable, as we discussed. I think that was 2 weeks ago when we first looked at that news. And this story is hilarious because it's Kevin Paulson writing for Wired and basically explaining chip and PIN to Americans. Not that we really need to go into it, but just have a look. It's like it's quite funny, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it starts out, you know, with the birth of the MagSwipe card and goes through to the current state of the US as a nexus for magnetic swipe card fraud. But yes, it's a good read. If you do need to explain EMV to the challenged, then it's a good place to start.
Oh, another hilarious headline from ThreatPost. Headline, no shit. Small signs of progress on DNSSEC.
that is big news.
It is. But and when they say small signs of progress on DNSSEC, you read the article and you basically realize what it's actually saying is no signs of progress on DNSSEC, really. Is there any meaningful uptake here?
Well, a guy from Cloudflare gave a talk at the Virus Bulletin conference and said that, you know, DNSSEC might actually be a pretty reasonable thing to do. So I guess on the scale of DNSSEC progress, that is pretty big news. Oh, dear. Kill me now.
Oh, we've got a couple of bug bounty pieces. Microsoft has started an online services bug bounty. I mean, the only surprising thing is there that I thought they had already. I thought they were doing this already.
Yep. So if you've got cross-site scripting in Office 365, they will pay you several dollars, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed. And they're not the only ones. Blackphone has opted to launch a bug bounty with proud Risky Business sponsor, BugCrowd. Good on them.
Yeah, exactly. This kind of deals with some of the fallout they had of having bugs disclosed to them on Twitter after their DEF CON presentations. Now they've got an actual proper bug bounty program. It starts at, $128 and goes up from there.
Oh, now there's a trends piece here on ThreatPost that I think is quite interesting, actually. And normally we just cover news here, but it says, headline is productivity gains trumping security as BYOD grows. I don't think anyone would be terribly surprised by that, but it is definitely something to keep an eye on because, you know, the job of a CSO is changing and BYOD is a big part of that.
Yeah, certainly. And the article kind of draws the line between, the productivity gains you get from allowing people to do BYOD and the risks that it brings. And that, in fact, maybe just kind of wearing the risks because of the productivity gains is actually not a completely unrealistic approach, which seems to be what everyone's doing by accident anyway. But yeah, if you're in the CSO space, I would have a read.
And finally, there's a piece here on Ars Technica. It's a tool release, Kali NetHunter, which, basically like a pretty decent toolkit you can now fire up on Android. Is this actually as cool as it looks? Because it looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. They've got a bunch of the Kali tools and security tools that come with the Kali Linux distribution and bodged them across onto Android, and actually done quite a good job if you've got Google Nexus Android hardware integrating up the onboard USB ports and various other bits of wireless hardware, that kind of thing, and doing a number of the USB attacks, the bad USB attacks that we saw demoed at Black Hat this year, so you can just plug it in and have it pretend to be a keyboard, all that kind of thing, all nicely integrated, and it's something that you might want to have a play with. within your lab?
Yeah, look, it's a very James Bond sort of tool, I reckon. The idea that you can just pull like a Nexus 5 out of your pocket, stick it into a, you know, into a targeted host and own it. That is pretty cool.
Yeah, I imagine it would work very well against those, you know, corporate registration kiosks and that kind of thing. It'd be good fun.
All right, mate. Well, that's actually it for this week's news. There was a hell of a lot of it. And yeah, it wasn't all good. But thanks a lot for that. And we'll chat to you again next week.
I look forward to it, assuming the world hasn't ended.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's news headlines, the very scary week's news headlines. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Don Bailey of Security Mouse. Earlier this week, he wrote a blog post called No Thing Left Behind. It was more or less in response to a Daily Dave post by Dave Itell. Dave used his post to take aim at the number of Internet of Things themed security talks out there. He calls it junk hacking. Yes, we get it, he wrote. Cars, boats, buses, and those singing fish plaques are all hackable and have no security. Most conferences these days have a whole track called Junk I Found Around My House, and Now I'm Going to Scare You by Hacking It. That stuff is always going to be hackable, whether or not you are thecavalry.org. It's not stunt hacking unless it can wow you. If you are wowed by someone owning XP these days, then you're out of it and need to be rereading Carolyn Meniel's Happy Hacker website. Yes, there is junk in your garage, and you can hack it. And if you find someone else who happens to have that exact same junk, you can probably hack that too. But maybe not, because testing is hard. Yes, you can connect a device to my midlife crisis car and update the CPU of the battery itself with malware, which can, in theory, explode my whole car on the way to BJJ. I personally hope you don't, but I know it's possible, the same way I know it's possible to secretly rewire my toaster oven to overcook my toast every time, even when I put it on the lower setting, driving me slowly but surely insane. So in any case, enough with the junk hacking and enough with being amazed when people hack their junk. Now, what I just read to you was an edited portion of the post. I've linked through to the full post in this week's show notes. Now, personally, I love posts like these because they actually stir up a bit of debate. And predictably, some researchers went off their nut when they saw this, saying they can own whatever the hell they like. Thank you very much. And they are free to submit these talks to cons. And it's up to the selection panels whether or not they want to feature this content. As for me personally, I love hearing about some junk hacking, like Silvio Cesare's latest adventures in owning home alarm systems, for example. But I do wonder if Itell has a point. Look at the breaches we've seen this year. We've seen terabytes of really sensitive information stolen from large corporations through the simple vector of spear phishing. All this while some of the world's finest minds try to own blenders. Well, Don Bailey of Security Mouse wrote a considered blog post on the topic. It's called No Thing Left Behind, and I've linked to it in this week's show notes. His view is that IoT is a big deal, but takes Itell's point that we've probably seen enough demos of hacks on home appliances and just, you know, things in general. So I grabbed Don for a chat earlier this week, and here's what he had to say.
I've actually been working on Internet of Things technology since about 2010. I've even broke a few devices myself. And I've given talks about those devices all over the world, everywhere from Syscan to Source Boston, even Black Hat Las Vegas, Black Hat EU, and quite a few other places.
So when Dave Itell wrote this post to Daily Dave, basically saying, can we stop talking about junk hacking, what was your immediate reaction to that?
He makes a valuable point, right? And it's actually something that I've been saying recently. Junk hacking, I don't really care for the term. I mean, stunt hacking, I think, is much more appropriate.
Well, it sounds cooler, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, stunt hacking makes more sense, right? Because the goal of this stuff is really to have fun and just do new research on a new thing that we never really thought would be hackable in the way that it now is because of this new IoT explosion.
But I think his point really, and I think it got lost, people got a little bit upset with his position, you know, and started saying, oh, it's important, since when do we need to justify ourselves and stuff? I think his point is that it may have evolved into a bit of a distraction. We know stuff is vulnerable. We know Internet of Things is kind of a problem, but there seems to be an undue focus on it. Do you agree with that?
Well, that was my point, right? And I didn't want to ramble on too long there, but essentially what we're both saying is that we've seen enough devices targeted. I mean, you can go day in and day out with all kinds of new devices that can or cannot be attacked. Most of them can be attacked, but so what? At some point, we have to kind of step back as an industry and say, when does it matter? When does it stop mattering, right? And I think we're to the point now where we've had great IoT talks for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years, and it's time to move on to other things. We know that things can be broken in very similar ways. We're not really seeing anything revolutionary from the IoT attack perspective. So I think now it's time to really regather the community's response to IoT and identify a more appropriate discussion. That discussion is going to have to be about, you know, the models and the architecture of these devices we're seeing.
One of the reasons I think, you know, personally, I think we've got here is because the real challenges that we're faced with in InfoSec are actually quite daunting, right? So hackers gonna hack, right? So they like to be able to just, oh, here's a new thing I can hack. So they're hacking that, and it's heaps of fun because that's the motivation. But meanwhile, spear phishing is resulting in the theft of terabytes and terabytes of data. You know, so it's like people are going around owning their blenders while the internet burns, you know? I mean, that's one thing that kind of concerns me. I think that's what ITEL was getting at. Do you agree that the sort of focused borderline obsession with Internet of Things is actually a damaging distraction?
I think it's kind of ridiculous to say that internet is burning at all. Things are much, much more positive today and much more secure than they were years ago. I mean, look at all the bugs that just dropped today, right? We've got the new bash bug, the NSS bug, a couple of other things dropped today as well. And really, like, we wouldn't be seeing major bugs like this dropped in succession anywhere near the frequency that we would have, you know, years ago, right? And the reason why we're doing that is because we've got a much better job of managing and building security technology, right?
And but amount of stolen data that's out there now is higher than it's ever been.
Yeah, but that's just because more people are using the internet in more novel ways than ever before. But we have ways to remediate those problems much faster than you would have ever seen years ago. I mean, if, you know, we would have seen extensive level attacks against iCloud in, you know, 2010 or 2005, those security issues would be nightmares to remediate in some semblance of a practical way. But today we can do that really quickly, right? There are ways to solve those problems with very little effort. And it does take some teamwork with the users themselves. And it's unfortunate that we haven't gotten past that point. But, you know, we're in a way better position than we used to be. So I don't think I think that we have problems. There are a lot of problems to be dealt with. But, you know, a lot of those problems are architectural. And a lot of those problems are our ability to deliver secure services to a user in an elegant fashion. But it's, you know, the technical stuff is getting either extremely difficult to do or exceptionally easy to do, but the things that are really easy to do can be mitigated very quickly. So, you know, I don't see it as big of a problem as we used to have.
So in terms of going back to Internet of Things, right, you're talking about trying to actually quantify the threat and look at what the threat really looks like from a macro perspective. What does it look like? Because we've heard about, you know, people saying, oh, we'll have pop-up ads on our smart televisions. That could be an issue. You know, people will use devices as footholds on the network. They're a great place to get your persistence. But really, what is the threat from a macro perspective of Internet of Things? Are they going to be used as DDoS agents? Are they going to be, you know, how is this going to bite us on the ass if we don't get on top of it?
You know, that's a really theoretical question. And I think that talking in theoreticals is kind of a waste of everybody's time, right? Because you can theorize all different kinds of attacks, right? I mean, there's a company out there that just got seed money, a couple million dollars or something of that nature, to complete work on the sensor that they have that runs on acid in a human stomach. So you swallow it, and the acids create energy and allow the pill to transmit data about your body to external sensor retrieval devices. Like, what the hell is the threat model for that, right? And how is that going to be used as a DDoS device or a way that we can attack somebody's stomach? Like, these are all bizarre theoretical discussions that really have no merit in, a sensible threat model. We can talk all day about the theoreticals, and we can model them to an extent, but really what's important is to identify the patterns that we're seeing in the existing technology and the evolving technology that's about to come out, and how the threat models need to be shifted to really manage attacks in those surfaces. So, yeah, I mean, we could have all these bizarre discussions about ad pop-ups on, you know, your toaster or whatever. But what really needs to happen is to identify what are the components in each one of these devices. How do they relate to all the other components in IoT devices? What are the associated and shared technologies that these devices use to not only talk to each other, but talk to ourselves, talk to uplinks, talk to backend databases, what supporting infrastructure is needed on the internet, what kind of management technology is used or needed in order to monitor these devices and identify whether or not there is a threat.
So, right? if I'm reading you correctly, what you're saying is we need to move the research from trying to understand the devices into trying to understand the ecosystem.
Exactly. Because really the problem is architectural. You know, I mean, when you go and attack the average Internet of Things device today, you're really just attacking a component, right? And the component is used by thousands of other devices. So you can have, you know, this theory that says, oh, I hacked a toaster that can turn into a web camera. Like, okay, that's fine. But what about that toaster that can turn into a web camera did you actually attack? And how did that component integrate into that technology to make it an Internet of Things device? And what 70 other things are using that same component in a vulnerable or potentially vulnerable way, right? So once you identify those patterns, you can understand the ecosystem. I mean, when I was doing my DARPA research, I got to a point where I was actually able to go on the FCC website and search FCC IDs and essentially look at write-ups on devices and the makeups of those devices and the components used in those devices. And without even having a physical device, I would be able to say, this device is going to be vulnerable in these three ways. This other device is going to be vulnerable in these other three ways because of the components and because of the ways the components were expected to interact with not only a device, but the user and the uplink, right? And that's an ecosystem problem.
So what are the issues, the biggest issues, the most pressing issues that you've identified that pertain to the Internet of Things ecosystem or the development life cycle? Is that the biggest issue? Is it what are the weak points here that could evolve into the most pressing issues when it comes to the ecosystem more broadly?
So the general problems with the Internet of Things, right, is well, there are a few items, right? Non-repudiation, provisioning, and monitoring, right? Those are a big three. Obviously, there are a lot of other issues, but for me, those are really the big three, right? You have to ensure that when a user takes an action, that the user that owns that device is taking that action, and you can prove that in some way, right? I mean, if somebody decides that their toaster is going to be Internet of Things enabled, and there's a problem in the Internet of Things toaster device, how do you differentiate between an attack on that particular toaster and, you know, Don Bailey using that toaster in a malicious way, right? So if somebody sets their apartment on fire, you have to be able to say, this was that person using that device in an inappropriate fashion. Or was it somebody on the internet attacking that device in a way they knew would cause a fire? That's a big deal, you know? So, identifying where we're lacking in the SDLC, and not just the SDLC, but the architectural definition of what that thing is, to really mitigate those risks before the product ever ships, that's extremely important. Provisioning is another really big deal, right? So how do you know that a particular device out there isn't being physically modified and usurped and passed on to somebody else? If you think that we have concerns today about iPhones being stolen on the streets of San Francisco, or any other city in our country or the world, think about when we have a bizarre array of really expensive Internet of Things capable devices, everything from your shoes to your coat to your watch to your glasses. We're coming to a new era of technology where everything is going to be monetizable in a way if it can be stolen from you. So identifying ways to mitigate malicious provisioning and stop a black market from being created, that's an essential piece of Internet of Things that is not being accurately discussed. And finally, obviously, just monitoring. You know, how do we identify whether an action is being taken appropriately or inappropriately with the device somewhere on the network, right? Because now we're talking about meshes, super meshes, mini meshes, and bands, W bands, personal area networks, all these different types of abstractions for networking. How exactly are people supposed to identify whether or not traffic within those networks is malicious or just a device joining and leaving naturally? You know, being able to identify that behavior and then tell an important piece of the network, an authoritative piece of the network, is still something that has to be solved. I mean, there are easy ways to do that as in just sending messages back and forth, but how can those messages be trusted? Do they come from a source or an origin that we can even trust? I mean, these are really difficult challenges.
Well, I, for one, look forward to the day that Liechtenstein decides to declare war on a country by using Internet of Things-enabled home appliances like toasters to burn down generals' houses. Can't wait for it. Sounds fantastic. Don Bailey, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Don Bailey of Lab Mouse Security there. Not Security Mouse. Sheesh, sorry about that. Big thanks to him. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Michael Jordan. Not Jordan, Jordan. Funny too, because I asked him about that and apparently he hasn't seen Office Space. But I think he'd appreciate it more than most.
Michael Bolton?
That's me.
Wow, is that your real name?
Yeah.
So are you related to that singer guy?
No, it's just a coincidence.
Oh.
Anyway, Michael Jordan is Context Information Security's Director of Research. Now, if there's one thing, if we're talking Internet of Things, that is already a bit of a problem in enterprise security, it's network-attached printers with shitty security. You know, default installs of NT4 used to be the problem for those beastie sort of copy and print centers. But these days, as you're about to hear, even some of the smaller and cheaper printers are ownable now and quite powerful, and that could really be an issue down the line. In fact, it could even be a bit of an issue now. Now, we're not talking about, you know, a smart thermostat here. You're talking about a device that you actually send corporate documents to. So to demonstrate the point that this could be a problem, and, you know, this is a great thing for customer demos, Michael Jordan decided to hack a Canon printer to see if it could run Doom on its little color display. Unbelievably, he was successful. Here he is.
Right, well, the story starts when in the office we looked at the idea of Internet of Things and the fact that they've got presumably insecure security. So let's take a look. So we had an evening of beer and pizza. We bought a load of toys and we started to have a hack into them. And what we found that evening was the Canon printer has a web interface on it, and the web interface doesn't have a username and password and can't even be configured with a username and password. So automatically you're thinking that's a bit bad. But looking through the functionality that's available, you could only really look at ink levels and boring things like that and print test pages. But then by looking further, you were able to upgrade the firmware and change the proxy and the DNS settings. So you could change DNS and proxy settings so it connected to my machine and then trigger a firmware update process.
And it's all unsigned, no crypto, no nothing.
Ah, they have got crypto in inverted commas. In looking at the actual binary that it downloads, it was obviously had some encryption, but very poor encryption. So, and then spent a few weeks actually reverse engineering how the encryption works. So to actually be able to break the key and break the crypto to then be able to extract out the firmware.
So what was the flaw there on the signing of the updates?
It was encrypting the updates, and the encryption was a 16-byte XOR key.
That barely counts as encryption.
Yes, that's why it was in inverted commas.
Yeah, right. So I imagine the challenging bit would have been then maybe reversing the firmware once you'd broken the air quotes encryption.
Yes, exactly. So it doesn't run Linux. It doesn't run any sort of operating system that I know about. It's just one big monolithic binary, which gets, you know, starts at the beginning and off it runs, and the entire of its sort of operating system functions and all of the application functions are all just in one big program.
So how did you go about pulling it to bits then?
Well, it took a bit of time to work out the different components that are in there. So there's a bit for the printer drive, there's the printery stuff, and there's a bit for the application processor, which does the bits from the web interface and the like, and the screens and buttons. And that was the bit I was focused on. It was compressed, so I had to work out how the compression was and then do the decompression. And at that point, then I could start to look through and use classic reverse engineering skills, sitting in front of IDA for hours on end, to actually work out what some of the components were.
Now, enter one of the 90s classics, Doom. Why was it that you decided that, hey, it's not enough to own this thing, reverse it? I mean, look, I get that it makes for an awesome blog post, but why on earth would you try to get Doom to run on this?
Well, so at that point, I was able to modify the firmware. I had worked out how to do IP-TCP connections by looking at it. So I could get a very basic stub on there, which I could connect and run my own code. So I thought that's kind of interesting. So what would a bad person do is they would write some malware that would run on there, that would steal the documents, be a gateway into their network. I think I could do that as a demonstration for sort of presentations. But then I realized that what I would be doing for my demo would be hitting print and a document would appear. And a lot of work would have gone in for what had been a very boring looking demo.
But I mean, so, look, that is the real relevance, though, of printer security, isn't it? Because it's an oft neglected area. I mean, I can remember as long ago as 10 years ago, network-enabled printers being used as an excellent place to get your persistence post-compromise. I mean, it's a great place to hide out.
Yeah, who suspects the printers? I mean, if you're looking for malware in a network, you're not going to start sort of reverse engineering the printer since it's been modified.
Well, and the nice thing too is that you do get the added benefit of being able to steal documents. Every single document that thing scans, prints, or copies, you know, bang, you've got it.
And that's probably the more important documents at the end of the day, the ones they're printing out.
Mm, but doom.
So... That's what I would have done if I was a black hat. But being a white hat, I thought I wanted to do an interesting demo. And the screen on that is 320 by 240 pixels, and it has a 32-bit processor. I'm thinking that's pretty similar to the 320 by 200 pixels of the original game, plus it had buttons on there as well. So I made the rather stupid decision, to be honest, of trying to get Doom to run on a printer.
And of course, they open sourced it years ago, didn't they?
Exactly. So it's open source. The code's there. It's been compiled and run on various things. So there's some ports which are sort of a bit more flexible. So I'm thinking, in theory, if I can get implement the necessary operating system features, because it doesn't have those, and I can work out how the screen works, then maybe I can get Doom running.
And you did.
Yes, so I spent a lot of my spare time for the next 4 months up to the conference, and on the day before I flew back for the conference, I managed to get it working.
So let me get this right. You go up to the printer, it's got its little colour display, and you turn it on and it loads Doom and you can play it with the buttons on the front of the printer.
I didn't get around to getting the buttons working.
Oh, okay. So does it just sit there playing the demo?
Yeah, so the video on the blog post, you can see it playing the demo. I got the colours right on the initial splash screen, but the colours aren't right thereafter. But it's just a matter of time. It proves the point. The speed of it running is not optimised. You know, I'm not a game developer, so my implementation of stuff is probably quite slow.
Look,
but
I remember
at a decent speed.
I remember when I got Doom running on my first the first time for me, and it looked like a frickin' slideshow, you know? So we've all been there. The fact that it runs at all is amazing. Are you thinking about adding some adding like the button support and stuff so you can actually play it on the printer?
I don't know whether I want to dedicate that amount of my spare time in my life to actually finish it off.
Well, I don't know. I think it could be an extra feature for the printers. And now, the other question, of course, is could you get it to do this and still work as a printer? I'm guessing not.
Yes. The printer I have, what I've done is I patched one of the web pages, so one of the web pages on it, so that when you request that, it then downloads a program and runs it. So the Doom doesn't live in the printer. The patch only just doesn't download and run. And then from that staging place, I can therefore download and run my Doom. So the printer will still work as a printer and a scanner and everything else. Just one little web page that's not important. It's been modified.
So you put it in Doom mode, basically.
Yes. You say, I want to run a program, and here it is. And this time it's Doom.
Excellent. Now, of course, you could have persistence, given that you've reversed the firmware and everything. You could have changed this so that it was, you could have put persistent malware on it, right?
Entirely, yes. It takes 10 minutes to flash the printer, so every time I made a mistake, I'd have to reboot it and try again. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to change too much in case I broke the firmware update process, hence why I went for the slightly more low-risk option. But if I was malicious, I would do that, and I would get into the boot, into the actual load cycle, put it in there, and there's plenty of space and memory and time for you to do what you want to do.
Now, as I said earlier, this has been an issue for upwards of 10 years when network-attached printers and photocopiers and things like that have come along. Do you think attackers are actually using attacks against things like printers in the real world? I mean, is that something that Context sees in the wild in incident response gigs?
I don't believe we've ever seen it yet out there. I think for sort of the criminal-based hackers, there's not much money in a printer because you can't steal credit cards and the like. So maybe that's slightly less sort of motivation for them. However, for sort of more sort of state-level kind of APT attacks, you can imagine this would be certainly something of interest to them. And if they need to, maybe one day they will turn to it if they haven't already and no one's seen it.
Now, one thing that I find interesting too is you've got Doom running on this printer, right? Now, 10 years ago, you couldn't run Doom on a printer. It just didn't have the grunt. So to a degree, mm-hmm. we're seeing some of these more advanced, second, third, fourth generation Internet of Things like printers, photocopiers, network-enabled devices. We're seeing them get more and more powerful. And it reminds me a little bit of what we saw with mobile phones. Right, they used to be very mm-hmm. dumb little things with monochrome displays, much like printers were, and then now they're fully fledged computers. Do you think these manufacturers, I mean, now, as you say, you've got a color screen, you can run Doom on it. Are these devices going to get more and more powerful? And what's that going to do to the, you know, the custom OSs that they run?
Yes, they're causing it more powerful because the chips are getting cheaper, the technology's there, and it allows them to add other features and the like because they'll have the processing power and the fancy GUIs. But the problem really with this is that things like, you know, Windows operating system and Linux operating system, they've been attacked for years, and they have a whole range of mitigations in there. They know what crypto is. They know they've got the protections, ASLR and stack cookies and the like. Whereas these modern OSs, these newer OSs that are for embedded devices and the various Internet of Things, haven't learned those lessons. And we're going back to 1990s hacking when we start talking about the Internet of Things.
Yeah, and one thing that really surprises me, and I've asked this question of a bunch of people who are familiar with the Internet of Things space, I would have thought that the industry would gradually move towards standardized hardware and software, right? So that you'd actually be using a common ecosystem, much like it's happened in, you know, mobile phones with the various, you know, OS manufacturers, Android being the perfect example. But people just tell me that'll never happen because they're sort of got that old school engineering approach. They develop it all in-house. Do you think that'll change? Because everyone seems to think no.
I would have thought that would change. I think that's the maturing of a technology. When a technology turns up, everyone races to get there as quickly as possible, and therefore they'll write their own if there's nothing out there, nothing standardized. But over time, it will be seen that actually there's more benefit to actually, you know, combining these different approaches and getting to a common approach, which then can start to have, yeah, common solutions to these problems. But it'll take time for the Internet of Things to mature to the point in which that would be necessary and there'd have enough people to do that.
Now, as I said earlier, it's my personal opinion that the biggest threat that these types of devices in corporate networks, and they're already there, we're not talking about future Internet of Things, you know, like your thermostats or your light controllers or whatever, these things are there now. The biggest threat, as far as, you know, I can tell as a dumb journalist, is that, you know, it's a great place to get persistence. Now, in that it's such a great place to have persistence, do you think CSOs who are listening should bother with a plan to actually deal with the threat that these things pose, or do you think it's just pretty low on the list of priorities at the moment?
It's persistence, and also add to that, it's a gateway into the network. Earlier this year, we did some research looking at a light bulb, and we were able to, it's a smart light bulb, it's got a computer in it, and we were able to get access to the wireless credentials for somebody who was running that light bulb
on their
wireless network.
Which light bulb is this?
It's a LifX light bulb.
Yeah, it's funny. I know one of the founders. That's an Australian thing.
Yeah, they're over in Melbourne, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's an old friend. I'm from Melbourne. But anyway, you caused some headaches there, bro. But please continue.
Yes. But that was an example where actually it was a gateway into the network because there's nothing of interest on a light bulb from a sort of attacking point of view. But if you can use that, those sort of mesh networks, then get onto the internal networks, you've then got a gateway in there. And as well, yes, you've got the persistence within the devices once you get in there. So in terms of worrying about it, I think the concerns would be to ensure that devices aren't sneaking onto networks, which people haven't even considered, haven't even thought about, being internet connected, and ensuring the separation between those devices and the actual important networks and important data.
Do you think printers, when they come into a network, really need to be considered as an internet connected device in the same way that a regular host is? Should there be like a standard operating procedure for connecting a network printer to a network? As far as the security team's concerned.
Yeah, I think the security teams do need to look at the printers and any other devices on the network as they would with a server, as they would with a switch or a router. Anything on that network, it has to be considered from a security perspective and understood what are the implications and what can be done to potentially mitigate or understand those risks and do things to actually ensure that they're secure. So whether that's if it has got a username and password on that printer, ensuring the username and password set. If it's a video conferencing facility, well, it could be used to spy on the office. Have they actually considered how it is configured and could be attacked and what you can do to prevent it?
So where do you catch that? Do you catch that during the procurement phase, or you just hope the security team picks it up when some, you know, mid-level IT manager plugs it in?
I guess you've got the two parts in terms of auditing the network to see what devices have randomly turned up and ensuring you investigate what they are. Just for example, if a vulnerability assessment scans a network, sees a printer or one of these devices and says, I don't know what that is, that doesn't mean that it's not a problem. And ensuring that it's understood what devices are on the network. And yes, when people are installing and adding devices to networks, that they, you know, have considered that a printer may have problems and maybe introducing insecurities.
Michael Jordan, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about your adventures running the classic 90s game Doom on a printer. Although I got to say, you could start adding different titles, you know, maybe Descent. Descent was a good one from around the same time.
Yes, it's a bit fiddly, if I remember rightly, and it gave you seasickness.
All right, mate. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll chat to you again sometime soon.
All right. Cheers, Patrick.
Context Information Security's Director of Research, Michael Jordan, there in this week's sponsor interview. And I really hope he gets those buttons working, because I think that would make the demo cooler. And that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by acclaimed Indigenous vocalist Emma Donovan, singing with the Melbourne rhythm combo The Putbacks. This track is called Daddy, and the LP, Dawn, will be released in the USA on November 11. You can get this track for free. There is a link in this week's show notes. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Stay safe out there, Bash users.
Hey, no rain on me. You ain't what I need. Daddy, ain't no use trying to set me free. See what you're hiding from me, Daddy. Ain't no rain on me. Said ain't no rain on me.
Ain't no rain on me. Ain't no rain.